welcome and thank you for joining me on this, which is my second podcast episode. Now, I really wanted to make this episode a little bit more victim and witness focused, and always also looking for things that are current and topical at the moment. And so one of the absolute obvious things that sprung to my mind in terms of what we could make this episode about was the community trigger. And many of you will know that the community trigger is a tool that was introduced as part of the Antisocial Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act of 2014. And something that was brought in really as a result of some of the serious case reviews that we had unfortunately seen over the preceding years. So I think the most famous, for all the wrong reasons, case that we are aware of is the sad case of Fiona Pilkington. And those of you working in ASB will probably be very familiar with Miss Pilkington and the sad set of events that surround that case. Essentially, Fiona and her daughter both had learning difficulties and were struggling with issues of antisocial behaviour being perpetrated towards them. And what happened was that Fiona did report some of those problems to her local agencies. And unfortunately, the response that she received didn't resolve the issues that she was facing. And sadly, it got to the point where Fiona saw no other way of escaping the problems other than to take her own life and that of her daughter. Now, with all serious cases like that, a serious case review took place, where it was the actions of the organisations involved were scrutinised to see whether there was any learning that could be taken, whether there was any recommendations that could be put in place. And one of the things that came out was very much about better understanding risk, which is why we now end up with risk assessment matrices that we use for victims, and that we work more in partnership and share information that we have about victims so that we can better support them and better respond to their needs. One of the things that the ASB Act of 2014 really wanted to do as well was ensure that victims and witnesses of antisocial behaviour had more of a say in the way that their case was being dealt with. So if they felt that their case perhaps wasn't being dealt with properly, perhaps they weren't seeing the response that they would have liked to have seen, perhaps they were being let down, that there would be a way that they could call organisations to task, get a review of their case, and hopefully get the case moving again in a more positive manner. And certainly I remember back in sort of 2011 when the legislation was first proposed, that one of the big pushes was around the element of victims having more of a say. And in fact, the white paper at the time was called Putting Victims First, which couldn't really say it any more clearly. And certainly the media at the time were very much focused on this idea of there being a trigger that residents could push if they wanted a case review. So I guess with all of these things, what we're really interested in knowing is how well has the ASB legislation, how well has the community trigger specifically actually achieved the aims that it was set out to do? And I'm really happy to say that my guest today is Jenny Herrera. And Jenny is, she won't thank me for saying this, but Jenny is very much kind of the leading authority, the leading voice around the community trigger. So firstly, just to say, Jenny, a huge welcome for coming along today.
Thank you.
My first question really is an obvious one, and it's really whether you can just introduce yourself a little and also tell me a little bit about the charity that you're chief exec for, so ASB Help.
Of course, thank you. It's lovely to be able to share, and I'm absolutely passionate about the community trigger, so I love all opportunities to chat about it, to highlight some of the issues. But ASB Help is a charity that was set up in 2013. It was the idea of a businessman who really who has a huge heart and just sense that victims are still out there. There are other cases like Fiona Pilkington where people need help and they go to local agencies and they're not being heard, or that they just don't know quite who they should be going to, what they should be doing. And he said, I want to set up a charity that looks to support victims of antisocial behaviour. And so I actually was running another charity for him called Acts 435. And he said, well, you're doing a good job there. Would you like to get involved? And I said, well, my background isn't in antisocial behaviour, though I have done auditing of public sector bodies. So I have some knowledge of kind of inner workings of some of these places. But yeah. I said, well, actually, you know, I'll be happy to get involved. And for me, it was absolutely fascinating from the beginning, because I sort of came in just as the 2013 antisocial behaviour bill was going through Parliament. So I kind of, because I was trying to soak up as much information as I could, I watched the way it goes through Parliament, the different issues that people were discussing, the IPNR, do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
The injunction for nuisance and annoyance. And the fact that, yes, the white paper said putting victims first, but then all this, the focus when the legislation was going through the Commons and the Lords was not really about the victim side of things. So basically for us as a charity, our focus is our website as our portal out there to victims, to signpost them on where they should go, how to cope with antisocial behaviour, and then, of course, what to do when no one wants to listen, which is where our focus on the community trigger came in so strongly.
Sure. So that's really helpful. So just to be clear for the listener, ASB Help is much more than just about the community trigger, but obviously you've realised that the community trigger is one of the key tools in terms of what the charity tries to achieve.
Yes, we victims do contact us and we're able to advise them, and we have obviously different web pages on different aspects of antisocial behaviour, how to cope with being frightened and frustrated and all those sort of things. But so many times the information that we're gaining from victims is, well, I reported it to police and then I reported it again and I tried the council. And of course, you know, 9 times out of 10, we're saying, well, have you tried the community trigger? What's that? And that's where our focus has come in.
So that's a really kind of nice way in then to my next question, which is, you know, I'm assuming that most of the people who have an interest in this antisocial behaviour podcast do have a fairly good insight to the community trigger. But I am aware we might have listeners who are maybe new to the sector, or perhaps residents themselves, elected members who have interest in antisocial behaviour. So would you mind just telling us a little bit more about the community trigger itself as a process?
Yes, of course. The community trigger, first of all, it does go by two names just to keep things confusing. So it's also called the ASB case review. In fact, in the legislation, it just talks about the ASB case review. But as soon as you come into statutory guidance, it talks about the community trigger. And before the statutory guidance was updated, it didn't even refer to the fact that that was the same thing. But so the community trigger is there for if you have reported 3 instances of antisocial behaviour in the past 6 months to any of the main agencies. They don't all have to be to one agency. You may have reported twice to your housing association and then once to the police, or, you know, any combination. That is called the threshold. So if you meet the threshold, which is usually 3 incidents in the past 6 months, your case will then be reviewed by a multi-agency panel from the main statutory agencies and other departments that they may call in, or they should do, in my personal opinion, so that together everyone looks at the situation. Is there something, how can we resolve the antisocial behaviour? That's supposed to be the point. It's supposed to be about how do we resolve it? Not let's make sure we've just followed all our procedures, but how can we resolve the problem? Just getting together, problem solving, looking at is there something different they can try to try and bring respite for the victim.
Fantastic. I think one thing that's really key perhaps to how well or otherwise this process works is the fact that, as you pointed out, that the legislation kind of gives a really basic skeleton to what this community trigger process should look like. And I think one of the issues is that this idea of localism, that each area then goes away and kind of fleshes out what that process looks like. And I get the reason why the government are so keen on things like localism. But I think one of the challenges, therefore, for the community trigger is that you do get those variations in the process depending on which area you live in.
Yeah, massive variations and also quite a lot of confusion. So that people are actually doing the process very differently in one part of the country to another.
Sure. And I think, I mean, I'm really keen to kind of pull out some of the key points that you're making here. And one of the things that's just, I've kind of scribbled down on a piece of paper next to me while you were talking, is this idea that you know, if most areas are using the three reports kind of rule of thumb as the threshold, mm-hmm. but that point mm-hmm. that you made, which is really, really important about the fact that that shouldn't be three reports to one agency, that should be three reports across all agencies. And when we look back at the kind of things that went wrong in the Fiona Pilkington case, it was because Fiona had reported to a number of different agencies and people weren't sharing that information. So everyone had a kind of single piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And because people didn't bring that jigsaw pieces together, no one could see the overall picture. And I just think that's such an important point that you raise about really understanding what that threshold means.
Yeah, just recently, actually, I was talking to some practitioners in the Northeast, and they said that the lead agency. So, OK, that's the other thing to mention, that in each area, someone different might be the lead agency. So it's often the council, but sometimes it's the police. So in the area that he was, it was the police, and the lead person said to him, "Oh, we've had a community trigger from this person. Can you send me kind of, you know," they wanted to check that the threshold had been met. So this practitioner sent in the information, the log of the dealings with this victim, which confirmed, yes, that there had been at least three reports, but because their log also showed what action had been taken each time, the police agency said that the threshold hadn't been met because they saw that action had been taken. It's like, no. If there's been three reports, the threshold has been met. Yeah. The multi-agency case review is what will decide whether the action has been taken. And I just thought that explains to me why in the Northeast, an awful lot of the stats that come back say they've had maybe 10 triggers, but all 10 didn't meet the threshold. Seven triggers and all seven didn't meet the threshold. That's why, because they've got confused about the whole process.
And they're essentially carrying out the case assessment independently at the very early stage rather than bringing it together.
Yeah. They're doing it straight away and then telling the victim the threshold hasn't been met, which is rubbish because it had.
No, absolutely. So I guess my next question is really, I know this has been certainly a piece of work that has been of importance for ASB Help and yourself for a number of years now. And while I really want to explore your most recent report and your most recent research and what came from that, also tell me a little bit about some of the things that you've done previously around the community trigger, because I know you did release a report a number of years ago as well.
Yes, that's right. We released a report in September 2016, and a lot of the focus of that was what we could see from just pretending we were a victim and looking at different websites. That's what I was going to say there, but it's just gone from my mind. I think it was because we thought, I know. So when we were looking at the website, we thought, what information can we give here? And we realised that actually a victim might hear about the community trigger, but have no idea how to activate it locally because, you know, everywhere is different. So we thought, do you know what? We need to produce some kind of directory, because this would be a helpful place for victims to come and then say, right, I live in Maidstone, put in their borough council and find their link. So now that was a big job. You can just imagine like 324 odd areas of the country looking, hunting down their trigger. Was it on the council website? Was it on the police website? Because I can't tell you that almost everywhere the lead agency will put information, but no one else does. No one else mentions it or links into it. So then we contacted lots and lots and lots of areas and said, where's your information? Please give us a link. And I'm pleased to say that bit by bit we managed, I think we've got a link for almost every area bar about seven or eight. And some of them are just because their website's being reconstructed or something. But in the early days, we only had about 50%. So as we were pulling all that information, trying to find out where the link was and putting together our own community trigger directory, we also gathered a lot of kind of information about what was going on around the country, the fact that some areas use different names, but most importantly, the fact that the statutory guidance is pretty clear about trying to make it really accessible, explaining it clearly. And what we realised as we looked at all these different links, that was so far from the truth. There were some really great examples where they were like, okay, this is what it is, explaining as clearly as you can what is actually a little bit of a complicated concept with the threshold, but explaining when you can use it. And then here's a phone number, here's an email address, and not just customer services at, you know, nottingham.gov.uk, but actually people that they could contact. And in the best situations like an online form that they could submit. But for every one of those, there are another two that just said, if you want to do this, call 101. And that was it. Now, that's about as inaccessible as you can get. We all know some of the issues that there are in calling 101. And people, you know, I've heard people say they tried, they gave up. All those that did get through the call, the person who took the call didn't know what they were talking about. So in our report in 2016 very much looked across the board how accessible had different places made it. And what we found out was that it was, you know, not at all accessible, that guidance had been frequently ignored. Limited publicity as well. So the fact that, yes, the lead agency would have something somewhere on their website, but it might be like far down a page about antisocial behaviour or just sort of a little page on its own. But how would you know to look for it? And we did a YouGov poll just to find out general knowledge of it, which would suggest only 3% of the country knew what it was in the first place. And of course, if you don't know what it is, you're not going to know to search for it. Agencies don't really recommend it to potential applicants. And then the other side of all that, which we found out, is that the fact that there's a legal obligation to report your community trigger data. So in the legislation, it says, you know, you need to report, you need to publish, in fact, how many triggers you had, how many didn't meet the threshold, how many case reviews you held, and how many of those case reviews had recommendations. But it didn't explain who was going to collate this. The Home Office has taken no role in it at all, and it's all done locally. The Police and Crime Commissioners had to get involved in the actual initial setting up the community trigger. They did that and then ran off and have had no further involvement. Some are the ones that receive the appeals. So like, who's getting this data? Where is this data? Where are they supposed to be publishing it? So then we also contacted all the councils and asked for their data, which then gave another interesting story to go into that 2016 report, which was, first of all, it was very difficult to get that information. Many areas treated it as a freedom of information request, even though it was, you know, they're legally supposed to be publishing it. People were using all types of different reporting periods. You know, some were just saying to date, others were doing October to October, others were doing financial year, and 44%, I think it was, had a zero return. So that's to say no community triggers at all in the period. Wow. And, you know, I just thought that, you know, for us, that is an indication that people don't know about it. Not that everything's working beautifully and they don't need any case reviews.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think it would be wrong. And I think everyone accepts that it would be wrong to think that we are 100% nailing antisocial behaviour as a profession and, you know, successfully resolving every case to the point that, you know, the reason why we haven't had community trigger activations are because, as you say, the world is rosy and there's no need. I'm interested, I suppose maybe this is a bit of a brutal question, really, not to you perhaps, but do you have any kind of thinking about why there's this reluctance to advertise, to promote, to make it accessible? Do you have any sort of thinking about why we're in this position where it's really difficult to find out about processes locally?
I think there's two things. One, the main one in the very beginning was that there were whole areas that were very wary of it and just thought, this is just going to create more work because we're just going to get the vexatious complainants who are just going to now use this as another way. I think there was just a lot of concern that people, having already complained to their local agency, were just going to use this as another form of complaint. But it was very much to misunderstand the reason it had been brought in. I remember talking to one police and crime commissioner and she said, you know, the police don't like it at all. And it's because of this. It's because they just feel like it's just another complaints process, which it isn't. And it wasn't ever designed to be. So that's one part. I think now that the issue, one of the big issues now is that there's been changes of staff, and for areas where there's been zero community triggers, I think, you know, there's obviously a lot of different things going on, a lot of things to remember, and I just think it's dropped off the radar. People have just forgotten that they even are supposed to have one. So, of course, they're not promoting it to victims. Of course, they haven't got a poster up in the offices. It's just sort of got quietly forgotten about. But you know, it shouldn't be because it's still fully part of our current legislation.
And but of course, if you've got nobody that is holding areas to account for their statutory obligations, like the reporting of recommendations and case reviews and figures, then why are any new staff going to think to even have those posters up? Because no one is coming on an annual basis and saying, as part of your statutory obligation, tell me how many case reviews have been activated this year.
So,
it doesn't surprise me. I'm interested to pick up here because I, as you know, I spoke at a conference, an RHE global conference, the guys who produced the Noise app a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that I spoke at length about actually was some of the findings from your most recent Community Trigger report. And one of the questions that the audience asked me was around, so what is the difference between a complaint and a community trigger application? And I just wondered whether you could perhaps give your view on that, because I imagine it is something that a lot of organisations perhaps think, well, why are we having a community trigger process as well? Because it is duplicating what we've already got. Where do you see the lines of difference?
I suppose for me, a complaint is you're complaining about either the way you've been treated, perhaps, by the agency, or you're complaining about sort of the standard of work that you feel that they've done. So for me, the focus there is very much on, I know that they are probably used because someone really wanted the next door neighbour to be evicted. And even though the antisocial behaviour has stopped, you know, that's their complaint. But it shouldn't really be, you know, they should just have to accept that the aim was stopping the antisocial behaviour. So for me, a complaint would be more a complaint about the way you've been treated, or just the general way that that particular agency seem to do its processes, and you feel like they've made, you know, some errors, or perhaps you've looked into their procedures and they haven't met their procedures.
Sure.
However, the community trigger is much more about coming together to problem solve. I think I see it, either it works best where agencies just aren't doing anything. And we've got a great example of that, one where a housing association was doing nothing, just kind of fobbing them off, really. It's those situations where they don't even get to the agency, and they were just fobbing them off, saying, oh, it's just, you know, just a neighbour dispute. And it turned out that there was even hate crime involved. And when they had the community trigger and everyone came together, the council was able to help the housing association see that, no, actually they should have acted, and actually they should have seen these wider issues. Now, a complaints process wouldn't have picked that up, because if you'd complained to the housing association that they hadn't taken your complaint, your report seriously, then they would have just been like, well, you know, they would have investigated, but it would have sort of missed the point. So I think it works really well when it hasn't even really been taken, people haven't been taken note of. And that's where, for Fiona Pilkington, you know, that would have been a situation where everyone comes together. The other way it works well is that whole thing where different people are doing different parts of the puzzle, or people aren't quite equipped to do it, or don't know the legislation well enough. And that's where everyone gets together and suggests to each other. But of course, that all assumes that partners work well, that they're not, when they get in these case review meetings, they aren't just trying to cover their backs and on guard. You know, they need to just be like, okay, actually, let's come together to help this person. And it comes back to, let's put the victims first. You know, we're here, we all get to go home at night and sleep in our homes and feel safe in our homes, and it's quiet. Let's just remember that that's not the case for this particular victim, and how can we improve the situation for them collectively? So that's kind of, and everyone may have done everything right. There may not be a complaint about anyone's procedures or the way that they've treated the victim, but is there something more that can be done collectively to stop the antisocial behaviour?
I think your point there about kind of neighbour disputes is a really interesting one, actually, because one of the things that I recognise from working with lots and lots of different agencies in relation to ASB is that often the most difficult cases to deal with are not the ones where it's serious ASB, but are the ones where it's neighbour disputes, where you might have complaints and counter complaints. You know, for most officers, they'll say, give me a clear perpetrator, a clear victim, and serious behaviour any day of the week, because I know what to do with that. You know, I've got legal tools available, it's very clear cut, brilliant, easy to resolve. The ones that take up the most officer time, the ones that come in open for years sometimes, are those neighbour disputes issues where essentially the officer has can't see the wood from the trees and has essentially lost control over that case and can't quite pin down who's the problem. And I suppose it's a real wasted opportunity here because the community trigger could be a perfect kind of solution to those kind of cases where maybe as an organisation you've kind of got a bit blind to the problem, and it would be really useful to have a, you know, third party input into that situation to see whether you have done everything you possibly could or whether somehow inadvertently you've gone off track a little bit and you need help being brought back onto it. And I just think there's a real opportunity there with some of those long open cases, you know, and perhaps it's even something around areas, you know, looking at whether part of the reason for reviewing a case is how long it's been open for. So could areas say, well, if a case has been open for more than 6 months, then actually we are going to do our own review similar to the kind of community trigger process involving others to see whether we are doing everything we possibly could be.
I think that's a great idea. You know, I think, I mean, you know, to try and, well, first of all, it'd be great with these neighbour disputes and problems to recommend a community trigger earlier on to the people involved and try and sort of do something before it goes on for years. But you're quite right. Once it started going on for months and months, let's get our heads. And I think, you know, that leads a little bit back to things like the ASBRACs. You know, different parts of the country do still have regular multi-agency meetings where they look at the high risk cases. Perhaps they should be looking at the high risk and the, you know, ones that have been going on for a long time and just kind of make sure that together they're putting their heads together and trying to problem solve.
I remember it sort of flicked my mind back to when the community trigger was first suggested, and there was a housing association based in the Bristol area that took it upon itself to kind of introduce a internal community trigger process, which was similar to that, which was essentially about being a little bit more proactive and not waiting for the resident or a member of the community to say that they wanted to push the button for the community trigger, but actually upon themselves that if certain criteria were met, like the length of time a case had been open, that actually the organisation would review the case anyway off its own back. And I just think that perhaps there's some quite good practice to take from that idea.
Yeah, definitely, I agree.
I just, before we move on to the next question, and again, there's a couple of things that you raised that I think is really important. So if you're listening to this and you haven't seen the directory that Jenny has referred to, then I would say it is a hugely valuable resource. So if you go to ASB Help's website, which is www.asbhelp.co.uk, that's right, yeah?
Yep.
Fabulous. And I will provide the link in the blog that accompanies this podcast. But if you go to the website, it's very easy to navigate to the community trigger pages. And what you'll find is the directory that Jenny's alluded to. And essentially, you just type in your area and how you activate the community trigger comes up for that area. And as an officer, as somebody working in ASB, it's valuable as well, because you might be new to the organisation and you might not know the process yourself. So definitely, definitely worth having a look at that directory. The other thing that you raised, Jenny, which I think is incredibly important, is you made reference to the fact that a number of areas use the 101 number as the point of activation. And I have to say, from personal experience of late, that is very problematic. I've been doing some work with a number of local authorities, and they have been, you know, some of the officers have been explaining to me that they've been encouraging victims to report things like breaches of injunction to the 101 number. And the 101 number for their area now tells them what number in the queue they are. And it's not uncommon for people to ring and be number 34 or 42 in the queue waiting to be answered. And I just think you're not going to wait for that long. And you, if you're reporting a crime, you're probably going to put the phone down and ring the 999 instead, which is not what it's for. But if you're trying to activate the community trigger, you're going to know that ringing the 999 number is not the right thing to do. So you're probably going to give up. And I just think it's incredibly sad that that's the case. So I guess it's a little bit of a plea, really, that if you are listening and you do know your community trigger process, and it does only give the option of raising a community trigger application through the 101 number, that perhaps you go away and think about whether that's the right thing to do or whether that can be changed, because that's certainly not going to make it a very accessible process at all. So no, I think really important points to raise, Jenny. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit then about the research that you've done more recently. So I think, was it just a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it, that you published a report?
Yes, that's right.
Outlined research that's been carried out more recently. So could you please talk us through a little bit about what that research looked like?
Yes, of course. Again, it was pulling together different pieces of work that we've been doing since our last report in 2016. On the different areas that we've seen and just thinking, well, what's happened 2.5 years on? The first thing to say is that everything that I said before about accessibility is still as much a problem as ever. So we just sort of reiterated that. We then looked a little bit more about the case review itself. So whereas before, if I'm a victim and I'm looking at what I would call the portal, so the actual information on a council's website, What do I think about that? What's the situation with that? But now what about what's going on behind? Talking to practitioners, trying to get a feel and trying to hunt down some best practice as well for good use of the community trigger. Mm. What we've sort of found in the mix of that is that, you know, the case review itself is fraught with problems. So even if someone manages to persevere through the 101 number or actually some councils put their switchboard number, and I've tried to get through to talk about the community trigger and been on hold for 20 minutes with councils as well. Yeah. So it can be bad there as well. They get through, and then a case review's held. Some victims have come back to us and said either they got a letter which just said we've had our case review and all procedures were followed, which, you know, is absolutely no help to them and not the point of it. But others have just made comments about the fact there was no one independent in that case review. So it was just kind of everyone just around the table just saying, oh, yeah, well, you know, we know this case. We're on it. We've done all we can, and not really sort of stepping back from it all. We would personally, in this report, we do recommend an independent chair. And also some victims who've wanted to be at the case review and they've been told no. We understand obviously confidential information, but the opportunity to get a victim there to actually be able to present their case and then step out of the room and everything would it just helps bring all the practitioners' views back to, okay, this is what this person's suffering day in, day out.
Yeah, there's a person at the centre of it.
yeah. So we've looked about that. Great. One council said that they, you know, as soon as they get a community trigger activation, they call the victim to talk to them. Now that is really rare. So, you know, it shouldn't be. That should just be a really nice thing just to chat to them, explain the process over the phone rather than it just being sending out letters. You've got to also remember that that is, again, making it inaccessible because some people, you know, if English isn't their first language or if they struggle with reading the kind of, I've seen some of these community trigger letters and I can't understand quite what they're saying. So, you know, they don't really think with the victim in mind. So we looked at that. We also did some work on the threshold and looked at all the different thresholds that were being used across the country and just realised that actually most are using the 3, and that why on earth wasn't that just made kind of a universal threshold after they'd had the pilots? Mm. But interestingly, there's some stuff that's not legal really that's going on. So first of all, in the pilots, which were done, I think in 2013, it was three for an individual, it was 3 different incidents of antisocial behaviour or 5 households. So they had this sort of 2-tier threshold, which is a little bit strange anyway, because I would say that if 5 households were all suffering, you know, that why should it have to get so big to hit 5? Why could it still be 3? Anyway, when the legislation came in, it just said 3. But let me tell you that nearly half of all areas still use this 2-tier, 3 and 5 threshold, even though it isn't even in the legislation. They've just picked it out of the pilots and just thought we'll do this. And it makes it harder to explain to victims. And it's not actually legal. The other thing that goes on is that some councils put that the case has to be closed for the threshold to be met, which is absolute rubbish. In fact, I would say that in most cases, the case hasn't been closed. And the reason that the victims are activating the community trigger is that just nothing seems to be moving fast enough. But then they're being told, well, the threshold is, you know, the case isn't closed, so we're not going to do a community trigger, which is just, yeah. So we looked a bit about that.
Have you got any feeling about where they are refusing to deal with it under the community trigger process? Is that still kind of getting a response? Are they still kind of, even if they're not looking at it through the community trigger process, did you get any feel that they're looking at it outside the process, or is it just it doesn't meet the threshold, so that's that?
I think it doesn't meet a threshold. They're probably working on it, but I, you know, if they don't, see, the problem is that communication stops with the victim. So the victim reports it, and then there may be stuff going on in the background, but no one bothers to tell the victim.
Yeah.
So, you know, then they trigger and then nothing happens. If they then get told, oh, well, yeah, the case isn't closed yet. Well, but then, and it's all back to these big faceless organisations that they can't get through to an individual person who can tell them what actually is happening with their case. And so they're just held so much off at arm's length and so far from the whole putting victims first premise that it's really disappointing, actually. And, you know, we understand that resources are limited and all the rest of it. And I think victims of antisocial behaviour are reasonable people. And they understand that if the police can't get round to them because they've gone to deal with some, you know, serious crime, they get that. But then don't never come back to them. You know, they can wait. But if it's this kind of like, there's a difference, isn't there, between not a priority, but we will come and chat to you and talk to you and try and understand, and simply not a priority, we're going to just fob you off. A lot of victims tell us that they feel like they're the problem because they're reporting the antisocial behaviour, which, you know,
is, I think it's really sad, because actually what we know what works in terms of good victim support. And we know, we've been saying for years, I mean, certainly since I started in ASB 15 years ago, it's the same basic principles behind good victim support, and the biggest one being communication. Because if you, as you so rightly say, if you don't hear anything from someone, you will assume that nothing is happening. So I always say to officers, even if you haven't got an update as such, just touch in and explain why there isn't an update at the moment. But just to make sure that the victim knows that you're still doing something. And I just think it's really sad to hear that we're still, we know what works, but we're still not great at it. So you talked a little bit there about some of the challenges that you came across. Did you have any examples of what was where it's working well, or any areas that are doing things particularly well? I mean, you spoke there about one great thing was about, you know, someone calling the person back when they received an application. I mean, that's fantastic. And again, goes back to the point about communication being so key. Were there other things that you came across that you thought, actually, yeah, that's good, I like that?
Yeah, we found some where, as I would say, it's worked as it was supposed to. So this idea, some councils have shared case studies where one example was a block of flats, and a lot of the flats were being hired out for on Airbnb. And it was short-term lets, weekend. So, of course, it was getting a load of hen and stag parties, an absolute you know, nightmare for the few residents of the flats that were actually owned. And they had reported it, and things were being done, but, you know, not joined up. Different agencies were trying to look into what could be done. And 6 months had gone past, and, you know, their weekends are just an absolute nightmare. So they activated the trigger, and both the victim and the council officer separately contacted us and told them, you know, how this is how it worked really well. And it was great to also hear from the victim and say, hey, you know, I've got an example here that's worked. And they all got together and looked at what had been done so far, and realised that they needed to get an enforcement notice out earlier because of the terms of the agreement shouldn't have been for short-term let. And it just sort of, but then the other thing is that they then informed the victims, you know, they gave a clear letter, like I think it was about a week after the case review, explaining what was being done, and the property management company changed the terms of rental to a minimum 28-day rental. They, you know, accepted that was necessary. I think there was a mortgage aspect to it as well. And that was it. Once it was a 28-day minimum let, then obviously you weren't going to be using it for weekends anymore. So everyone came together and, you know, immediate respite for the victims. And just really good satisfaction on both sides that this is what it's all about. We all get together and see what we're doing. And I think another one, just this idea of like looking at different options. So there was one with a housing association, and the victim was complaining about noise from one of the neighbouring properties. And the housing association was focused more on the actual noise and what to do about it, and was it a statutory noise nuisance? But actually, when they had the community trigger meeting and they kind of asked what the other partners asked him questions and got a bit more information, it turned out that actually the person, the tenant, wasn't actually there. She had moved out and her son was in the property, but subletting wasn't allowed under the tenancy agreement. So, you know, they said, well, focus on that. Forget, you know, the actual noise issues and what you can do about that. You know, let's be creative. Actually, here's the issue. And so they went back and they, you know, talked to the original tenant, said that subletting wasn't allowed. She didn't want to lose her property. She moved back. Problem stopped. So, you know, this is it. This is where you see, yes, it can work. I do get the fact that some people are going to use a community trigger to just complain about something that just either noise monitoring equipment's already gone in and there really isn't a noise. There's perhaps mental health involved. You know, some people are going to use that, but then it's nothing to be scared of. If everything's done and you've done what you can, there's really no harm with coming together and just, you know, confirming all that. It's a great tool. And actually some practitioners have said that they've gone into situations where there were no recommendations to be made. Everyone had done what they could. Things were progressing or the case had to be closed, but it was actually a good opportunity for everyone to come together and just, you know, audit themselves, really check that they've done everything they needed to, and also for partners just to get together around cases and keep those conversations going.
I have to say, I think there is a real benefit, and you're right. I mean, one of the big concerns that I heard time and time again when I was delivering training on the new ASB legislation was around the community trigger being abused and it just being another way of a vexatious or persistent complainant to be able to shout loudly.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the wrong way of looking at it, because actually the organisation should be embraced in the fact that, one, they can review the case. One, what that might flag up is this concept that we've already talked about, which is maybe there is something else and the organisation just hasn't seen it themselves. So brilliant, you might find a solution. Or secondly, that actually, if it is determined that everything has been done, you know, or maybe it isn't antisocial behaviour, it's a perception or sensitivity issue, that you can go back to that complainant. And it's not just about the housing association, for example, saying there's nothing we can do. That's then backed up by the police and the local authority also saying, yeah, we think housing have done everything they should do. And I think it's just that extra, you know, kind of credibility behind the housing association's decision that actually it was, they have done everything they can possibly do. So I think you're right. I think actually for vexatious persistent complainers, it can be quite useful in itself. And I suppose the other thing, I mean, we when we talk about vexatious persistent complainants, we very often automatically think of people who are abusing, you know, intentionally being malicious, trying to create problems for neighbours. But you're absolutely right. Some people, there might be mental health problems, and that is what's instigating the multiple contacts. You know, perhaps they're lonely and that's their social interaction is making complaints of ASB constantly. And again, what that gives the opportunity is to recognise that, and perhaps through the case review and the recommendations, is to encourage mental health teams, support teams to get involved. So I think we do have to recognise that there are lots of opportunities here, and we need to get away from this idea that it is that kind of duplicating a process that already exists, or you know, adding extra things that we have to do.
Definitely, and we've heard practitioners say that they will recommend, or of course you can act, an agency can activate it on the victim's behalf. So sometimes an agency will activate it on a victim's behalf because they know that that's the only way they're going to get mental health around the table. So, you know, practitioners, it is actually a tool for you as well, because you can use it to get those partners around the table who you can't get hold of for one reason or another, to sort of feed in to the case.
Can we, however, pick up at this point on accountability? because I know that, you know, I've read the report, and I know that one of the things that comes through quite loudly is about there are challenges with these, with this process, and one of the biggest challenges is around accountability or lack of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we make, I think, a very good point about the fact that this process could be great at bringing people around the table that we've struggled to get around the table otherwise. You know, so a recommendation could be made that the mental health team need to engage or social care need to engage, which is brilliant. But actually, let's think about this in reality. There are no kind of, there's no teeth behind the recommendations. If someone doesn't do it, then there's no one holding them to account. And I know that's a little bit of a theme that you found in relation to various areas of the community trigger process. Can you just talk me through a little bit more about that in terms of the your concerns around accountability?
Yeah, from start to finish, really, the first issue is the issues I mentioned about legality and adding these extra conditions. So saying a case should be closed, I can acknowledge that and say that is wrong. I can tell them that's wrong, but who else can I tell? Who's going to actually say, you've got to change it, you cannot do that? We would argue that the Police and Crime Commissioner could be someone placed there, but at the moment they've got no mandate on antisocial behaviour, so they're not going to do anything. So it starts right there. So if you are not making your community trigger accessible, or if, you know, for those eight where there's no information at all, who, you know, where can I go to complain? Where can victims go to complain? So nowhere. And when I've told the Home Office about it, they've just said, well, you know, I think they've said, oh, yes, that's concerning, but someone needs to actually do something and follow up on it. Then when it comes to the case review itself, yeah, there's no one making sure that certain parties are there. There's no one making sure there's someone independent there. There's no one making sure that if a victim did want to be able to attend, or a victim's representative, so perhaps if someone provides some form of victim support in that region, you know, the if they want to be able to come and the case review say, you know, no, we don't want you, they've got nowhere to go to kind of say, well, you know, why can't I? And so, you know, the community, because it's all these different partners, there's no obvious one person. And then, like you say, when the recommendations are made, I know that some practitioners have been highly frustrated because they go through, because it does take a lot of work to get everyone together, bring all the information together, have a case review, get some clear recommendations, give the recommendations, and then nothing happens. And I heard a very, very sad case about this just a month or so ago, where a council told me that they'd been a community trigger case review in the September of 2018. They'd had the case review. They'd made recommendations to one agency. The agency then didn't do them anything for ages. When they finally did, like late November, they didn't kind of do the full recommendation. They just sort of put something in place for a month. In January, the victim sadly passed away, and the council practitioner told me that she really feels that the stress of the antisocial behaviour contributed to her failing health. And then now another victim also affected by this same antisocial behaviour has now activated the trigger again. And this is just ridiculous. You know, if there's no requirement to act on recommendations, then the whole thing is going to fall down at the last hurdle.
It's a very dangerous game as well, I think, because regardless of whether there's any direct sanction from abiding by the recommendations or not, essentially, what you do have is a review that's taken place with written recommendations. There's going to be minutes from the review somewhere. Yeah. There's going to be a record of reviews taking place. There's going to be a record of the recommendations that have been made. If, you know, the worst thing happens and you do end up with a situation like Fiona Pilkington, where that victim decides that they can't cope anymore and a serious case review is conducted, then the organisation that has worked against those recommendations is going to be placing themselves at incredible risk of being criticised, because in black and white are the clear recommendations of what organisations think they should be doing. And I just think that's a very risky game to be playing. Yeah. But I think with all of these, we just never believe that the worst is going to happen. You know, and we hear about these serious case reviews, but we never really believe it's going to happen in the organisation that we work in. I just think it's a very dangerous game to be playing.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I very much feel like that situation could happen. I guess because I'm the one hearing from victims in different parts of the country. telling me just the horrors they're dealing with, how it is pushing them over the edge, how they don't want to live. And so I do see it. I'm like, well, you know, if something happens to someone, the first thing that people are going to be saying, well, wasn't something brought into legislation to stop this happening? Oh, yes, community trigger. Well, how come this victim didn't know about it? Well, because it isn't publicised, because it was just, yeah. Or maybe it's only the 101 number, or yes, they did have a community trigger. And as you say, recommendations weren't followed. There's what I believe is a fairly straightforward, simple way to step in to review these important cases. They ignore that at their peril, basically.
Mm. No, I absolutely agree. And I think, I mean, we've had this conversation and risk of turning this into a bit of a rant, which it's never supposed to be. You know, we recognise, I mean, we both work with the Home Office and, you know, we recognise that at the moment, rightly or wrongly, priorities are in other places. They're simply not with ASB. And, you know, we've seen a little bit of a tail off perhaps in local area priorities as well. And it just feels like it's that really unfortunate position where the focus and importance is only going to come back when something terrible happens again.
Yeah.
So, you know, we recognise that we are at risk of a serious case happening and only then will the focus come back again. And that just seems so wrong. So very wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to, kind of end on a positive note as we possibly can, I think. So I guess one of the things I really wanted to achieve through this podcast is letting practitioners have some kind of real practical guidance, suggestions that they can take away and use to improve or develop the processes they work with. So I just wondered whether you have any kind of top tips on things that you would say to an officer about how to best use the community trigger process. Are there any things that you would really recommend or suggest?
Yes, of course, plenty. we would recommend, first of all, that you start by looking at what information's on your website, making sure that's clear, just putting, or, you know, maybe get someone you know who isn't in ASB to read it and see if it makes sense for them. Is it clear? Is it, you know, can they understand what it's supposed to be achieving? Just, you know, try and make that, as we said, as accessible as possible. Put a named officer in if possible, but certainly make sure that phone numbers aren't switchboards, that forms are made as straightforward as possible, because really, let's face it, they don't need to write pages and pages. I would say it just needs to be describe the three incidents and who it was reported to. You know, that should be enough to then pull that information together. So first of all, it's just, let's look at our portal. How clear is it? How accessible have we made it? We would also really recommend making sure that the other agencies in your region have it. So, you know, if you're a council practitioner, does the police have some information on their website directing victims back to your page with all the detail about the community trigger? And your police and crime commissioner or mayor, if you're in Greater Manchester or London, you know, have they got clear information about it on their website as well? So we would really recommend just kind of championing that side of it. When it comes to the actual case review, it really is just those things like, you know, who is chairing this meeting? Is it someone at the right level? You know, is there a way to try and make sure it's someone independent of the ones who are doing the work? You know, are there some straightforward ways to just make it, you know, just get that kind of the right tone, I suppose. Like, we're coming together to problem solve. You almost need to have that on the table in the middle, like problem solve. You know, we're coming to help the victim. And we would, you know, really recommend that there's someone who represents the victim or the victim themselves can come in and speak. But you know what? If that victim's rep has spoken to the victim on the phone or gone and visited them ahead of the case review, then they're going to come in with up-to-date information. You know, the power of being able to say, well, I spoke to the victim yesterday and this was what their weekend looked like. And just to kind of put the victim first. You see, if it's just a meeting behind closed doors, you know, the victim's voice is just still lost, really. And that's quite a simple way. My sense is that the community trigger has really got a lot of potential and they're quite simple ways to just make it more effective. And just make sure in any community safety partnership meetings you have, just to remind practitioners that they can activate it on a victim's behalf. And also they can be recommended to the victim. You know, they should just say, well, this is something that is this is available to you, should you wish to use it, if you've got to the threshold.
Fantastic. I think there's some really, really helpful and as you say, easy advice. Yes. And stuff that we can place that. I think that's the kind of irony of all of this, is nothing that we're suggesting is difficult. The process itself isn't difficult. It, you know, something's going wrong if it is difficult. So yeah, no, that's really, really helpful. I guess a plea overall would be that now we're, 4.5 years since it came into force?
Yep.
That, you know, it would be the perfect time to review how things are going, review how the process is working, perhaps review whether the threshold is right, you know, and all the things that Jenny talks about in terms of chairing the meetings, you know, what the meeting is actually designed to do. You know, it's an opportunity for review and support rather than to criticise or rap people over the knuckles with. It just feels like now could be the right time to review what we have in our local areas. And hopefully the work that you've done, Jenny, particularly around the report, will maybe put it back into people's minds and hopefully kickstart some of those reviews and maybe lead to some areas refreshing what they do.
I really hope so.
So it just leaves me really to say a massive thank you, Jenny. I really enjoyed speaking to you, and I could speak to you for many hours longer, I'm quite sure. But thank you so much for giving up your time.
Well, it's been lovely to chat to you, and thanks for having me.
Thank you. So just to let you know where we kind of go from here, I have made the kind of commitment that after each podcast, I will put together a blog post which kind of sums up the key points. And I've been busily scribbling them down next to me because Jenny's made some fantastic points, which I'll be translating and putting into a blog post, which will be followed up kind of a week after this podcast episode goes live. So look out for that. I'll also put in the web address for ASB Help, so that you can find out a little bit more about the work that ASB Help do and the Community Trigger Directory. Other than that, always a plea from me that if you'd like to come on and be my guest, I promise it's not as scary as it sounds, you have some interesting things that you'd like to share with people, then please, please, please do get in touch. Until next time.